This is the lecture for Biochem 421 for November 10, 2009.
Today's November 10. This is Biochem 421. We're in the middle of chapter 15. Proteolytic activation of chymotrypsinogen. But we're going to move on quickly to the lactate dehydrogenase isozymes. All right, now, if you recall, and I might have used the wrong term, I think I might have said alcohol dehydrogenase isozymes, but this is actually lactate dehydrogenase and isozymes, that there are two different isozymes, actually a variety of isozymes, that are available. There are two kinds specifically of subunits. The lactate dehydrogenase has four subunits in it. But those four subunits can be made up of two different types of subunits. You can have an A-type subunit and a B-type subunit. And you can see here where in the liver, the isozyme of lactate dehydrogenase that consists of four identical A4 subunits predominates in the liver, and very little anywhere else. You compare that with the heart, and you see the isozyme is almost all B4 subunits. Four of the B4 subunits. You take a blood test, and these, for example, that heart, lactate dehydrogenase, there is not a significant amount of B4 or A4 in red blood cells or circulating in the bloodstream. In fact, there's very little of it actually circulating in the bloodstream, but very little of it in the plasma. So if you have a heart attack and cells begin to die, then they release this B4 isozyme into the blood, and they can check the concentration of that lactate dehydrogenase enzyme in the blood and determine the severity, at least to some degree, of the heart attack. That's why they say they do a couple blood tests, and then they say, oh, well, the heart attack wasn't as bad as we first thought. Because when they take the blood tests over a period of time, they don't see a really high rise in the amount of B4, this isozyme of the heart. But he might go up and say, but you know, we did detect in that blood test a lot of liver damage. Have you been drinking a lot? And you go, wow, how'd you know? You know. Well, because your liver is damaged and there's a lot of A4 in the bloodstream. You may have cirrhosis because you're damaging your liver cells because there's a lot of A4 in it. And so that's the kind of conversation you might have to have with the patient among hundreds of others that enormous amount of information you can get from the blood test anymore. All right. Okay, here's the term, isozyme. Any of the genetically variant, is this at the bottom of your handout? Yes. Forms of certain isozymes that catalyze the same reaction with many different activity, composition, or physical properties. That's the definition of an isozyme. All right, now, we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to be studying hemoglobin as a paradigm for allosteric modifications or allosteric behavior. Allosteric behavior, and I'm going to slow down here so that you can listen and not just write. All right. Well, I know when you're listening to this on the radio, as it were, it's going to be a little dead air, but I'm not going to say anything right now. Are we mostly done, would you say, filling it in? Ideally, I should have it such that it comes in as I pronounce it and you can write it in, but I just haven't gotten that sophisticated yet. Okay, what is allosteric behavior? Well, that's what the definition is. Of or involving a change in the shape and activity of the enzyme that results from molecular binding with a regulatory substance at a site other than the enzymatically active one. This binding is not covalent. This is not a covalent interaction. It is a... It simply is one that they're attracted to because of salt bridges or hydrophobic interactions or whatever. But it is a temporary binding. Just a temporary binding, not a covalent one. And it changes the shape. So allosteric behavior means you have something temporarily bind on the surface of the protein. The protein changes its conformation, and the behavior of the protein is thus changed. We're going to be looking at hemoglobin and myoglobin as the paradigm for that allosterism. There we go. Sorry about that. All right. So hemoglobin and myoglobin, oxygen transport and storage proteins. Compare oxygen binding curves, hemoglobin, high myoglobin. Myoglobin is monomeric. Hemoglobin is tetrameric. Myoglobin is 153 amino acids. A hemoglobin is 2 alphas of 141 and 2 betas of 146 amino acids in length. Fundamental pieces of information. Here are the binding curves for hemoglobin and myoglobin. Let's take a look at the pieces here. Percent of oxygen saturation of the myoglobin and the hemoglobin. You go from 0% to 100%. Here you go, the myoglobin is the top curve, the hemoglobin is the bottom curve. The 100 torr is approximately the arterial partial pressure of oxygen. The venous pressure, that is the returning pressure after it delivers its oxygen, is about 30. If you're working the muscle, if you're running or moving at a significant clip, you sometimes drop the PO2 down to between 10 and 20. And given that, so let's take a look at how we can parse this particular diagram and understand it completely. I want you to note that one of these curves is hyperbolic and the other is sigmoidal. The sigmoidal curve, of course, is hemoglobin. That would indicate what C word? Cooperativity. Yes. And what did what of course did Sesame say? Street say? Cooperation, making it happen. Cooperation, working together. You remember that? No. Sesame Street. Oh, okay. So someone that threw me a bone. Somebody help me. Thank you so much. I'm not just singing to hear myself, my head rattle. All right. Now, let's take a look, shall we? And what I need for you to do here, I want you to go to this point, right where that arterial PO2 crosses the myoglobin. And if you were going to point at that, what percentage of saturation would you put there? 99? 98? Okay, I don't care. What would you say? I don't think it's 98, but I'd call it probably 94, 96. Let's call it 95. Put an arrow right there and say 95%. Also say, you could say, or 95 out of 100 sites. 95 out of 100 sites. Then down here, what would you put for the hemoglobin? What would you put? If that was 95, this must be what, 90? Put in 90% or 90 sites out of 100. What am I saying, 90 sites out of 100? What does that mean? 90 sites out of 100 have what? Oxygen, correct. Now then, let's go to where it crosses the venous blood. This is after it's been transported. So, obviously, myoglobin is not in the blood, but if it were, what percentage would it have in your... The one I think is... This is like your lungs, arterial PO2, and right here, the blood leaving your lungs, and I like to think of that as your big toe. The blood leaving your big toe is right there. If you had myoglobin in your blood... Leaving the big toe, what percent of saturation would it be right there? It's got to be less. It looks a little less. 91%? Maybe 90? Call it 90% right there. Or is it higher than 90? It's above the other line? Okay, so 92, 93? All right, 93%. Let's make it an odd number. 93% or 93 sites out of 100. What would you say here for the hemoglobin where it crosses? What percentage is that? 70. Okay, 70 sites out of 100. 70%, 70 sites out of 100. Okay, now let's go to the working muscle here, and let's call that 78 sites out of 100. Put 78%, 78 sites out of 100. Okay, and down here at working muscle, put in, wow, that's got to be 10 sites out of 100. 10 sites out of 100. Okay. 10% or 10 sites out of 100. Now, why are we going through that silly exercise? Because what is the purpose of hemoglobin? To what? Deliver oxygen. Both pick it up and what?
Drop it
off. It's not merely to transport oxygen. If all it did was transport oxygen, we'd be in real trouble because it can't really transport it off. It has to pick it up and what? Drop it off. That's the purpose of hemoglobin. What's the purpose of myoglobin? Primarily storage, actually. All right, so let's take a look. So if you pick up, let's take a look at hemoglobin. You pick up the arterial blood and you deliver it to a resting muscle and it drops it off. Let's see here. The difference between what it picks it up and what it drops it off. What saturation was it in the arterial blood? What do we call that? 90. And at the venous blood, it was what? 70. Difference between 90 and 70 is what? 20. So in an average, out of 100 molecules, 100 binding sites, 20 of them deliver oxygen from the lungs to the big toe under normal circumstances. What about myoglobin? Same situation. You start up here at 95, you end up with what? 93. So how in the same oxygen concentration, how much does myoglobin deliver? How much does myoglobin deliver if it was delivering anything? 2. Now, what would you rather have in your blood? Hemoglobin or myoglobin in terms of pickup and delivery of oxygen? Hemoglobin, of course. Of course. All right, so, you know, let's see here. Let's just pretend for a moment that Ryan ordered some pizza from Pizza Hut, okay, and had it delivered at the dorm, but they couldn't find him. Because he was studying biochemistry in somebody else's room. And he suddenly remembered he ordered that pizza, and he looked out the door, and there the delivery truck was taking off. He decides to run after the delivery truck. All right? He's going to get his pizza because he's hungry. Now, he moves from having venous blood concentration of P30 down to the working muscles in his major muscle groups of having concentration of 10. That's a difference of how many, what partial pressure? From 30 down to 10 or 12, what's that partial concentration? How much does that change in its partial concentration? About 20 torr. But it moves from delivering 70, having 70 sites after delivery to delivering how many sites after being delivered? 10. So you go from 90 in the lungs to 10 in the working muscles. And all of a sudden, just because he demands it, there's a demand for oxygen, you move from delivering 20 per 100 sites to delivering how many per 100 sites? Between 90 and 10. 80. By lowering the oxygen tension, 30 torr out of 100, it moves from delivering 20 to delivering 80 out of every site. Tremendous variability. And you are dependent on that. The fact that when you start running, to get that pizza, you don't faint from lack of oxygen, is because of that tremendous variability in delivering that oxygen. And that's dependent on that hemoglobin cooperativity. Okay. Biochemists, how can we describe that mathematically? Well, we use association to describe reactions. We do a binding constant for this business. And so this is actually reactants over products, because this is a dissociation. This is a binding constant. So this is reversed from what you normally would expect it to be, because biochemists use it a little bit differently. So this is for myoglobin. This is very, very simple. You've got the free myoglobin, free oxygen, MbO2 bound, and you can create a dissociation constant of reactants over product here. Now, fractional saturation is defined as a fraction of binding sites actually occupied by the ligand of interest. And let's take a look at what that looks like. Fractional saturation is... Oh, look. You have to actually write some stuff in. YO2. Would you mind subscripting that the YO2? The YO2 should be subscripted. YO2. Okay. And MbO2, Mb plus MbO2. What happens is that you can take... Let me just put everything in there. Is there one more? Oh, no. Okay. All right. I'll just be quiet as you write in this equation, et cetera. Very straightforward. And I've got to keep talking so that people don't think the podcast is dead. Long live the podcast. The king is... I've always wondered about that. They'd say, the king is dead. Long live the king. Because well, they went from king to king. So the long live the king was the new king. Are we all done writing this down now? Okay. Now, what happens is, by this definition, the fractional saturation of oxygen is simply the amount that has oxygen all over the total amount. If you would circle Mb plus MbO2 and simply say total amount of myoglobin, and the top, of course, is the amount of myoglobin that has oxygen bound to it. And so those two, by definition, is that. It's just simply that. The total amount of myoglobin, which is bound and unbound, added together, dividing into the amount that has the oxygen bound to it, and that's the fractional saturation. If you take this equation and the previous equation, if you take this equation and let me go back, and this equation right here, you see where the KMbO2 is? You take this equation and this equation, and you can reform it to form this O2 all over K plus O2. Right? That's all you need. I'm not going to ask you to do it, but just trust me. Now, the O2 concentration can be thought of as the partial pressure of oxygen right there, PO2. And the P50 is the partial pressure of oxygen when half of the available sites are filled with oxygen, and that can substitute for the P, for the K, and you now have the YO2 is equal to partial pressure of oxygen, all divided by the P50, that is the pressure at which half the sites are bound with oxygen, plus again the PO2. This turns out to be a hyperbolic curve when you do it. And so this curve fits the oxygen binding curve of myoglobin very well. This curve fits the oxygen binding curve for myoglobin very, very well. And so you get this really nice sigmoidal curve. Here is another curve taken from another textbook. Looks remarkably similar to the first one that we looked at. Is that correct? Do you see the similarities? Okay. Myoglobin versus hemoglobin. Again, we're just reviewing this. We can see that PO2 in the venous blood is about 30, PO2 in the arterial blood is about 100. Myoglobin does not display cooperative binding. There's no sigmoidal curve to it. It's a hyperbolic binding curve. What its purpose is, it increases the average oxygen concentration in the cell. It's got a P50 of 2.8 torr. So that means it doesn't take much pressure of oxygen to fill half the sites. In other words, that 2.8 torr of oxygen fills half of the binding sites for myoglobin. Hemoglobin does show cooperative binding, that is, because you see a sigmoidal binding curve. It has excellent oxygen transport properties, which means it both picks up and delivers oxygen pretty well. It's got a P50 of 26 torr. So its P50 is right about here, where it's half bound, and for myoglobin, it's bound about 2.8 is with the partial pressure. So there's a tremendous difference here, very similar to the previous diagram we saw. Now, we're going to be looking at something known as the Hill equation. Did I need to go back? Did I go too fast? Okay, let's go ahead. And I don't know why it's doing this, but at any rate, the Hill equation, if you wouldn't mind filling in the equations there. Let me tell you what the Hill equation is. The Hill equation gives us a measure of the cooperativity of a particular enzyme that displays cooperativity behavior. Anyway, so the equations are E plus SN yields ESN. You, again, in this case, the dissociation constant is reversed. What we're used to, reactants over product. The fractional saturation, we put that in there, and we combine this, and we get this YS, the fractional saturation, for a cooperative enzyme, binding ligand and receptor, SN equals all over K plus SN. SN. Now, when you look at this, are you done writing it down? Okay. When you look at this, what is the difference between this and the myoglobin binding curve, where it has YO2 is equal to what? This? What's the primary difference that you see in the two equations? Can you tell me? What is it? The exponent. Give the man, raise your hand. The man said the exponent, and he's absolutely correct. Excellent. And I didn't mean to wake you up. I'm sorry. Okay. The exponent, exactly right. That exponent provides the kind of numerical value that will provide that sigmoidal curve as opposed to a hyperbolic. If that N is 1, this reverts to a simple hyperbolic curve, just like oxygen for myoglobin. But many times that N is not 1. So the N gives you this Hill constant. The N is the Hill constant. And, okay, so we need to review. Please write this down, okay? There's a variety of things. When or if N equals 1, that's this Hill constant, the enzyme displays no cooperativity. N equals 1, no cooperativity. Be a hyperbolic curve. If N is greater than 1, the enzyme displays cooperativity. If the N is less than 1, it displays negative cooperativity. If N is less than 1, the binding to the enzyme or to the substrate receptor binding displays negative cooperativity. What does that mean? And what's a negative cooperativity? What would be the concept of negative cooperativity? Positive cooperativity is the binding of the first ligand allows an easier binding for the second, third, fourth. A negative cooperativity would be the binding of the first would decrease, exactly, decrease the likelihood of binding of the others. And there are some negative, Hill coefficients like that. Now, N, the value of N is equal to the number of binding sites on the protein. So N equals the number of binding sites. You cannot have an N greater than the number of binding sites on that protein. Having said that, how many binding sites does a normal hemoglobin molecule have for oxygen? Four. Exactly right. There are four subunits. Each subunit can hold one. Therefore, for hemoglobin, N can have a maximum of four. Okay? And if you had a perfect HB, if N equals 4, okay, your binding curve would look something like this. It would be perfect. It would be go. First one binds, and the first one binds, and all of them bind. And boom, you get 100% saturation almost immediately. But that's not, of course, what happens. There's definitely a sigmoidal shape to it. This is not in there. But anyway, you get a sigmoidal shape to it. Most times, hemoglobin has an N value indicating cooperativity of 2.8 to 3. 2.8 to 3. So it's not certainly 1, much more cooperative than 1, but it's certainly not as cooperative as if the N was equal to 4. Okay, so this is a diagram of what myoglobin and hemoglobin look like. We're going to try to explain the binding curves for that. Here's the detailed structure of myoglobin. Okay, so do you have this particular outline? Can you see the letters buried in here? Yeah. You see down here where it says 1 and 2? And then right here you have A. And then you got AB. Then you got a B. Then you got a C. And then you got a D. Basically, you're looking right down the helix. Then you got an E, an EF, an F. You got an F prime in there. F. Then you got a G. Then you got an H. All those alpha helices have been labeled in order from the beginning to the end. And so there have 8 helical segments designated with letters A through H, counting from the end terminus. And you're going to see then that you can designate a particular helix and a particular amino acid in that. For example, they have designated that H is one of the alpha helices in both myoglobin and hemoglobin. H is one of the alpha helices making up the secondary structure of both myoglobin and hemoglobin. And So H is right there. You can see that. You can also see that F is one of the helices in the myoglobin. And I want you to note this designation, HIS F8. That indicates that we're talking about a histidine that's on the F helix, the 8th position in that helix, from the start of that helix, from the end terminus. So you go to the F helix, you go in 8 residues, and you should find a histidine. That HIS-F8 turns out to be a very important amino acid side chain. You're going to hear a lot more about it in just a minute. That HIS-F8 exists both in myoglobin and also in hemoglobin. Let's take a look at the heme in hemoglobin. Oh, let me do one more thing. On the previous page, where we're looking at myoglobin, the subunits for hemoglobin have one fewer helix, and they're missing the D helix. Hemoglobin has the same letter designation for the helices, but it's missing the D. There's no D in hemoglobin. There's a D in myoglobin. There's not a D in hemoglobin. So there goes A, B, C, E, F, G, H. HIS, there's a HIS-8 in myoglobin. There's a HIS-8 in hemoglobin. All right. What's going on with this heme, or as you can see here, heme, as it's spelled in the British system, or if you're from Canada. Diffusion in tissue thicker than 1 millimeter is too slow to support life. Right? Concentration in 37 degrees is too low to support life. If you were simply, even if you had a circulatory system that was circulating everything but the hemoglobin, you still would not be able to support life because, as you know, according to, I'm not sure which law, but oxygen concentration, dissolved gas concentration actually decreases in hot water than in cold water. This is why sometimes, in certain times during the summer, there are certain nuclear power plants that have large ponds for cooling water. If they break loose and move into a stream or into a lake, there's a big fish kill. Because that hot water, while it's not radioactive or anything, but the hot water does not contain any oxygen, and they suffocate. And why trout are found in cold water, because they need more oxygen to survive. Okay? That's why trout are found in flowing streams that are cold. All right, with hemoglobin, blood concentration of oxygen is near atmospheric conditions. Do you realize that? In your big toe, or in the center, right in the middle of your liver, an artery is bringing oxygen at a concentration very similar to atmospheric concentrations because of hemoglobin. All right. The name for heme, the chemical name, is protoporphyrin 9. The iron is in the 2 state. The iron varies between having 5 or 6 ligands. Carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide, and hydrogen sulfide can bind to heme more strongly than oxygen. Can bind more strongly than oxygen. Okay, so what's going on here? Let's take a look at the structure. Anybody recognize this structure, the fundamental of this structure? What if I replace that iron with the magnesium? What would I have? If I replace that iron with the magnesium ion, what small molecule would I probably pretty close have? Chlorophyll. Chlorophyll. Don't ask me why, but chlorophyll. Isn't that amazing? I mean, the structure is only different in the margins, okay, out here. Otherwise, it's identical to chlorophyll. All right, so put magnesium. So you got iron in the oxygen. Notice right now the molecule you see here has 6 ligands to it. 6. It's got 4 to the nitrogens here, 1 to the nitrogen of this histidine. I wonder what histidine this is. I want you to write under here HIS-F8. Write under here HIS-F8. HIS-F8. Then up here is oxygen. Notice it's bent at an angle to because of the correct angle of the sp2 hybridized oxygen has the lone pairs at 120 degrees, and so that's why it's got that bent angle right there. Iron 3, if it gets oxidized, will not transport oxygen. It has to be iron 2. Iron 2. Now, what else do I want to say about this? Where does this fit? The hemoglobin, the heme is basically like this. Looks like somebody's grabbing a hamburger. That's the globin part of it. If you make your fingers fat, flat, slip it in there like that, something along that line, that's the heme and the globin. Boom, fits in there like that. There's just a big enough gap for an oxygen to fit in where this knuckle is here, and that knuckle is then that's the iron, and the knuckle is connected to a globin, HIS F8, down here at the bottom, covalently bound. And so the oxygen can be bound or not bound, but the histidine is always bound to that iron. All right, hemoglobin. Oxygen must bind oxygen lungs and release the capillaries. When oxygen first binds iron to the heme is drawn into the plane of the porphyrin ring. This initiates a series of conformational changes that are transmitted to adjacent subunits. All right, so basically, what you have here is the following. I mean, you could do this yourself. When there's no iron present... No, when there's no oxygen present, there's only five bonds to the iron, four to the nitrogen and one to the histidine. When oxygen is not present, dink. That iron sticks up like this. The bond length between the iron and the nitrogen is not ideal to fit in a plane in that porphyrin when there's only five bonds. So the iron sticks up a little bit out of the plane. This is flat. It sticks up like this whenever it has only five bonds to it. Get this out. So if I and this is difficult to see, but if this is the histidine bond to that knuckle iron, what happens is when oxygen comes in and binds to the iron, it goes from five ligand to six ligand. And that flattens it. It shortens the bonds between the iron and the nitrogen, and the heme goes from being puckered or cone-shaped to flat. And it pulls on that histidine, which then pulls on the HIS F8 alpha helices and acts like a lever and transmits a conformational change throughout the alpha subunit, which then transmits a conformational change throughout the tetramer and allows the second, third, and fourth oxygen to bind more readily. All right, so let's review that again, shall we? Puckered with no oxygen. Okay? Oxygen binds, the heme flattens, pulls on the HIS. Okay? The HIS gets pulled, guess how much? 0.6 angstrom. So it moves 0.6 angstrom. That 0.6 angstrom is on a lever-like material, lever-like structure in each of the subunits. So that then moves as the histidine gets pulled down into the heme. It causes a lever-like shift in that F helix, which amplifies the conformational change, shifts the hemoglobin structure to accept more oxygen readily. This initiates a series of conformational changes that are transmitted to adjacent subunits. And we are done today, ladies and gentlemen, and you can see that on this next slide. Yes? Yeah, right here. There are four bonds to nitrogen in the central core of the heme. There's a fifth bond to nitrogen that's permanent down to the histidine, HIS F8. The variable bond is number 6 between the iron and the oxygen. So that's a temporary bond. If the oxygen is not there, then there are simply 5 bonds, and the length of those 5 bonds do not allow the iron to fit inside that nitrogen circle, and it puckers up a little bit and pulls that histidine a little bit. And when the oxygen then binds, actually... See, it's actually like this. The histidine is down here. When the oxygen binds, it goes, flattens up, and pulls up on that histidine, and then creates a conformational change throughout the rest of the molecule.